My name is Clancy. I'm a Muslim. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to be here tonight. This is the 33rd trip I've been out here, Christmas, and we're approaching consistency. I'm glad to be here. I know it's always kind of a big moment. It's always a Saturday closest to Christmas Eve, and sometimes it's Christmas Eve, and the first year, I know there's some new people here, and I know that our leader tonight tried to fill you in a little bit, but it was absolutely incomprehensible what the hell he was saying, so. When we go and talk, I'm known as pitiful, and he's incomprehensible, and we have a tendency to demoralize. But anyway, just a little brief background. In 1960, I was still over 2 years sober, and I was hanging around the AA club one night in December, and they called up and said the speaker had canceled out or something on Christmas Eve in West Covina. I never even heard of West Covina, but they said, could the club furnish a speaker? Well, I didn't bother taking it up with the club. I just thought, here's my chance to make my move. So I graciously said yes, and I said, yes, we'll get out there. And I found a guy to give me a ride out, and I had a shirt and tie somewhere, I guess, and I was living in a little one-room apartment over in Hollywood. So I got out here, and we came out here, and we found this little, underneath the Legion Hall in the basement, there was an old tired, it was Christmas Eve that year, there was an old tired Christmas tree, and looked like a veteran, and about four other Christmases, and a bunch of, I don't know how many people, 15, 20 people, standing drinking coffee, kind of people that have no place to go on Christmas Eve. Just the leader that night was the same leader we have tonight. Well, I'd never seen him before. That was before he started dyeing his hair gray. People ask me why I don't have any gray hair. As soon as I see one, I pull it out. But I was feeling kind of testy. I didn't feel very good. I sent my children some presents in the mail, and that's all I could do. They were living in a post office box in Dallas, and I sent my parents a card, and I had no money. I was working in some little sleazy job, but at least I was sleeping in a little apartment. And I came out here, and I explained to them. I said, you know, also I didn't have any front teeth, which I'd had them kicked out just before I got sober, and I hadn't been able to replace them. So I carried my lip like this a lot. And many people did not know I had front teeth. I thought I'd been scarred in a fire. I was vocationally challenged, as they say. And I figured I'm out in the country somewhere, far away from anybody I know. I thought, because I wasn't from Los Angeles, I'd never even been out in this area, so I told them the truth. I said, I thought Christmas was a crappy night, and it was nice when I was a little kid, go down to my grandma's house in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. My dad would take me down on my sled, and my mother would come along, and we'd sit around the house, and my grandpa and my uncle would smoke cigars, and that's why I was associated with Christmas. We'd be waiting, the tree would be heaped with presents, and we'd wait for my uncle and aunt to come down from Minneapolis so we could open the presents, and I always wanted a pony, or I wanted something, and I never got it. I got a little train once in a while, or I got a... One time they told me Santa Claus had been killed. That was the Depression, actually. It was not my fault. But anyway, and I remember that Christmas Eve was a glittering thing and lovely, and late at night I'd be tired and sleepy, and my dad would put me in my snowsuit, and I'd be on my sled, and he'd take me back across the little lights would be glittering in the snow in the small town, the smoke coming out of the chimneys, and that was Christmas. And everybody came. And then as the years get along, you get more and more commercialized, and you realize that it's all kind of a bunch of crap anyway, and pretty soon people turn. And I had a lot of bad luck at Christmas anyway. I was one Christmas I was unfortunately in the insane asylum, was actually where I was. And they saw on my record that I directed a grand opera at the University of Texas that spring. So most of you heard this story, but they allowed me to direct the Christmas pageant at the Texas State Insane Asylum, which was not a very complex production. The and as I've said many times, the director's main job was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you want to go. Get back there, Lamar. And I was in Navy Hospital at Christmas. I lost things at Christmas, and I ran away at Christmas. Christmas was always, when I got older, it was not a very pleasant time for me, because deep inside of me, there's always been a little boy who wanted Christmas to be like when I was 8 years old. And I, at one time, I thought maybe I had an inner child. But it turns out there's no outside on this, so it's just a child. I have an inner adult now waiting to get out. That's better get out pretty quick, because I'm not going to last long. But I was, and then, so here I am in Los Angeles, on the run from Texas, on the run from everywhere else, my family gone, everything gone, my children gone, my teeth gone. You can get new children, you can get new families and homes, but it's like our book says, we are like people who have lost their teeth. They never grow new ones. Whatever it says, who knows what that book says. There may be people here tonight who have lost teeth and are embarrassed and humiliated. Let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. I don't explain it. It's a phenomenon. I don't. But anyway, I told these people that I thought Christmas was crappy. It was commercialized, and it was sick, and I was tired of these goddamn fools. And my first Christmas sober, I'd been so, I was 2 months. I remember told them about that, how I was living in the backseat of an abandoned car back at the AA club, and then we went to a meeting that night. Everybody going, I'm going home now and do this. And there I was sitting in the stinking club. Everybody got home, and they want to close up. And I said, you can't close early. And I said, yeah, we can. And I didn't want to hear any more about Christmas. I was sick of it. I didn't know what to do. And I walked 6-8 blocks down Fairfax to Cantor's. Because Cantor's was a Jewish delicacy. I think if there's any place in town they're not going to be saying Merry Christmas, it's going to be Cantor's. And sure enough, they didn't. They kept calling Hannah somebody. But I really was a terrible, depressive speaker. I just said, helps, but Christmas is crappy, and I wish they never had Christmas, and I just wish to Christ it'd go away, and I'm goof. Now, to give you a little insight to the West Covina group, when I got done, they came up and said, God, that's a wonderful talk. Would you talk for us next Christmas? Well, maybe. I was quite thrilled, actually. That was my first entry in my address book and my calendar. So I came out the next year, wasn't on a Christmas Eve, and I gave much the same talk, except things were a little better now. I was living in a little better place, and I had a little better job, and my family allowed me to send them a little more money. They said, well, you're starting to lose your edge, but can you come out again next year? Maybe things will... And I came out the next year and things were a little better, and And I had a little better job, and I was working in the medical corporation now, and I was on my way up to becoming advertising manager, and I'd got some front teeth by now. I smiled at the drop of a hat. He said, "My sister died."
"Oh, that's all."
And then went on. The next year I came out and I was advertising manager of that company. The next year I came out, I was working at Revell as advertising director of a big toy company. The next year I came out, I was working at KHJ in Hollywood. And then it just got a little bit better, a little bit better. My family came out when I was 5 years sober, in the end of my 4 years sober, and they came out. So some of them came out with me from time to time. And over the years, it's been, now it's 33 years, 33 times I've come out here. And it's just getting to be a kind of a thing. And things have changed a lot. The little girls that I didn't see for years have now grown up. Three of them are in AA. And you might, the three are alcoholics and two aren't. And so three that are alcoholic are in AA. And a lot of years ago, I used to think, wouldn't it be wonderful to have your child in AA? And it really would. I remember when I was at when I was up in Seattle, the International Convention, I had my three Alcoholics Anonymous daughters with me. I roomed with one. I've told the story before, but it's kind of an insight. She was sober about a year and a half at that time. And we were lying in adjoining beds late at night after the first night of meetings and so on, and I was so full of joy for her and happiness. I wanted to share with her. I talked for about an hour just on insights and understandings. It took me 25 years to pick up. And I said, and this is what you do. And here's what you look out for. Here are the actions you take. And I really, God, I just was transformed. And I got all done. She says, I heard out of the voice of out of the dark saying, "Well, that's all very interesting, Dad, but I'll have to check it with my sponsor." Which, unfortunately, is the correct answer. But anyway, these kids have been at AA, and they've come along, and I was quite touched about it. And I really have never had any bad thoughts about it, in a sense, until tonight, really. And I have one daughter in AA who lives in Southern California. And she came here tonight. She's here. And she took my goddamn seat. So I'm sitting up here on the stage with these short timers. She's over there. She says, "If you make me give you my seat, I'll tell Mother." Enjoy, honey. Your mother won't be around forever. That's a terrible. I don't mean that. Her mother will not be around forever, but she'll be around long enough to tap dance on my grave for several years. But that's the way this meeting is combined. Then there were, 15, 18 people. Next year there's a little bit more. Now it's a big thing. And we're here on a continuing basis to always do the same thing, in a sense. Then it was truly an anti-Christmas talk. This is not really an anti-Christmas talk because I believe in Christmas and I believe that it's a wonderful place. But I also know that Christmas is a great minefield for people like me and for people like you, if you'd be like me. Because of what? Because of the nature of my illness. The nature of my illness is alcoholism. And what in the world would that have to do with Christmas or anything else? You think we of all people should enjoy Christmas and thoroughly enjoy it. But it gets back a little bit, I suppose, to what I was saying a few moments ago. And that is the tendency for people like me, and therefore I presume like you. We cannot ever talk about we, but alcoholics of our type. Now, every so often people are baffled in AA meetings. There seem to be people who seem to be alcoholics who, after all, don't go to meetings and they're fine. There are people who take no steps and they're fine. Alcoholics who do all sorts of things. And I think when Bill Wilson wrote this book, although he wasn't able to identify it, he identified that there was some different approach to this thing. And that's why he said alcoholics of our type, which tells us there are alcoholics of other types, alcoholics who respond differently. Alcoholics, for example, the Chick Shadell up in Washington, who tell us that they can cure alcoholism in a week, 10 days with a couple follow-up meetings. And they have successful patients, people out in the world doing it. And you say, how can that be? Well, they are not an alcoholic of my type. There are people who have all kinds of treatments who work. Some people just say, I decided to quit. And you say, how can that be? Because they're not alcoholics of my type. People who get to AA usually are alcoholics of our type, because they have a combined illness, a combined thing of mind and body. But when you're going through it, you don't worry about these ramifications. And this alcohol problem is as strange a problem as you'll ever find in the world. There is no other illness like it. You tell a guy he's got a heart disease, he asks, what can I do about it? You tell a guy he's got tuberculosis, you really jump. Here's a funny thing. For some no apparent reason, as some of you know, I work on Skid Row. Today on Skid Row, we were talking about on the way I'm out today, all over the country, there's an epidemic of tuberculosis on Skid Row, all over the country. We have 90 employees at the Midnight Mission. We just all took it out, we took a test to see if we were positive to the tuberculosis bacilli. 72 of us were positive. 72 of us have been exposed to tuberculosis. And we don't know what that means, of course. So we, a week and a half ago, we brought in we hired a X-ray unit to come down, set up in our building. And we took X-rays of all 72 of us. I was one of them. By a stroke of great luck, not one of us had tuberculosis. But we've all been exposed to it, and we will test positive as long as we live. That's a funny phenomenon. I never need to take another TB test, because I will always test positive from now on. But you tell somebody you got tuberculosis, and they jump. But you tell somebody you got alcoholism, and they know you're wrong. Considerably more fatal than tuberculosis. Considerably, you tell somebody he's got dengue fever, and he'll say, oh, there's been 5 cases of dengue fever in the last 100 years. But they, you know, tell somebody they're an alcoholic. Now, what kind of a disease is this? For example, we were talking about this last night. In the last few years, I've had 3 or 4 people that I sponsor who have died from cancer. And they have died from a particularly malignant kind for which there was no help. Today there's help. There's various types of chemotherapy, and many people respond to it. But these were people who didn't have this. They didn't have all the medical technology, I guess. And I spent a lot of time in that UCLA hospital, one after another, with these people, Sandra and Ramon and a couple others. And I used to sit in that ward, and some of the people were going home, and some were getting better, and some were in chemotherapy. And one of them, Sandra, went up there, who was given up as a hopeless case because she had cancer in her lymph nodes. She got better. She got better. I mean, you can get better. But most of the people there aren't going to get better. And I used to look around there and think to myself, Riley, this was 15 years ago maybe. You know, I wonder what these people would say. This guy over there dying, sedated, almost like a hospice situation. What would he and his family say if you went over there and said, hey pal, would you take the time to go to a meeting every day with a bunch of people and drink some coffee and eat a donut perhaps and have a few laughs, maybe an hour and a half a day, if I could cure your cancer? What do you think they'd say? They would say, here, let me sign over my house to you, my car, anything. Take me, for God's sakes, take me. If you ever want to see a particularly dismal sight, a particularly, maybe the most dismal sight in the world because of its back, because of its situation, down in the county hospital, L.A. County Southern USC Hospital, which is L.A. Charity Hospital, they have a charity ward for low-bottom AIDS patients. And these people are not being treated at all. They were not treated. They were dying them when they came in the door. They're just running out the string. And you see those people thin and covered with sores and sick and desperate and not, never been treated. Now, what do you think they'd say if you'd go there and say, "Hey, pal, I got 12 steps that seem kind of silly and dumb, but would you take them on a continuing basis if I told you how, over a period of time, if I could cure your AIDS?" They would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. They would lick your feet. But you go to that county hospital in an alcoholic ward to give an AA meeting, and the guy will lay there with his liver out to here, and his skin yellow, and his eyeballs yellow, and he says, "Get that goddamn meeting out of here, I'm not an alcoholic." And you come back next month, and he's dead, and the guy in the bed is saying, "I'm not an alcoholic." Now, what kind of illness is it that you can be days away from death and still not accept the fact you got it? It makes you just want to wonder what the hell's wrong with such people. Over the years, I've had the opportunity, the last few years especially, to travel to a lot of places around the world in AA, and be at AA meetings in exotic places like Christchurch and Auckland, New Zealand, and Tahiti and Mexico and Canada and Glasgow and Dublin and Belfast and Paris and Berlin, all kinds of exotic places. Kind of looking forward this year to touring South Africa in April. See all those dreary towns down there. But I used to be excited about going to those places. I'm not excited anymore because it's always the same. And all over the world, it's the same thing. But there's some people apparently think, well, when he's right, at least he communicates well. And I get little notes from people from New Delhi, India. Someone sent me your tape, "Thank you very much for helping me," from someone I never heard of. Now, this big communicator, I work in the middle of Skid Row where people are dying around me from alcoholism. I should be able to go out in the front street, as I was tonight. We stopped there tonight, and I saw a couple guys cowering by my doorway that I know well, and I talked to them, stopped and talked to them for a while, and they're going to die in the street. And one guy used to be our truck driver, and I really had great hopes for him, but I never was able to communicate with him in the fact that there was something really drastically wrong. It was always a series of bad breaks. Now, if I can help somebody in New Delhi, India, for Christ's sake, who I never heard of, why can't I help this guy standing outside my doorway who's dying, who I would give anything to help? And it gets back to the basic nature of the disease again, the thing that is so frustrating about it. Because what causes alcoholics, in my opinion, to die from alcoholism is always the same thing. It is something that is present in me and in you and in every alcoholic of our type on a continuing basis. Now, that doesn't mean having it's going to make you die, because we'd all be dead. But it's there. And it's nothing big and it's nothing dramatic. It's just that little voice that says, "But my case is different." Now, you might stay sober a while and think that feeling goes away. But you wait till the next time you're cross, or the next time someone hurts your feelings, or the next time somebody hurts your feelings in a meeting, or the next time something goes on that's inconvenient for you, you will find that feeling again. And you will have it as long as you live, in my opinion. But you say, if that feeling kills you, and you have it as long as you live, why are we all dead? Because the feeling itself does not kill you. The feeling left untreated kills you, left unattended. Because left to its own device, it gradually will grow until it seals you off. And then nothing can get in. I see people who would give anything to understand what I'm saying, but they're trapped in that cocoon. Now, if a guy on Skid Row dying in the cold rain feels that different, certainly you and I wouldn't feel that different. The guy in this county hospital with his liver out to here can still prove he is not really an alcoholic. You and I can still prove we're not alcoholics, because it always gets back to the same old argument that's always there. But my problem really isn't alcohol. Not really. It looks like it sometimes, and well-meaning people think that's what it is, but only I know. I have feelings that no one knows about. And I have sadnesses that no one can really determine. And I can't really determine them myself. And I've tried psychoanalysis, and I read books, and sometimes they help for a while. And I tried joining clubs, and I tried doing things. But the only thing that's ever really helped me overcome those feelings is a few drinks. And that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. I guess over the years, in and out of AA, I was out of, in and out of AA year after year after year. The last day I drank, I was 9 years more convinced I was not really an alcoholic than I was the first year. That all AA had done for me was convince me I'm not really an alcoholic. Because alcoholics, it seemed to me, the message I got, and I'm sure the message many of you seem to have gotten, is this. If you're an alcoholic, your problem is alcohol. And you get sober, and you clean up your act, and things get better, and you live with some degree of elan. Now, what do you do if you're not like that? That means you're not really like him. I get sober, and I feel good for a while, but pretty soon the good feeling dissipates. And one morning at 2 a.m, I can lie in my bed and look up and see my old pals coming back to start to visit, drop in for visits. Mr. Desperation and loneliness and resentment and self-pity and wondering why I've been screwed around my whole life by people and why they're doing this to me and feeling upset and feeling trapped and just can't, nobody understands. And when those pals come to keep you company, it isn't going to be long then, folks. Because when you get a head full of that, the day is going to come pretty quick where you can't handle it. You go to AA, that's nice. Go to psychotherapy, they can take runs at your emotions. They can sometimes even find out why you have them. And I've always been under the feeling, I'm sure many of you have too, if I can just find out why I have these feelings, I'll be all right. And I want to tell you, based on thousands of dollars and years of effort, I want to give you some good news and bad news. The good news is, if you work at it, you can find out what causes these terrible feelings. The bad news is, it doesn't help. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. The only possible use I can even imagine for that kind of information, maybe late at night in the bar, some big guy comes over and says, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you?" And then you can tell him. Well, I'm sure. I'm afraid to say, "You're a wise ass." Just trying to explain. And you can read books that some you can understand and some you can't. Rash of great, you know, one of the things that makes AA kind of a puzzle in a sense, because there's so many books come out in the last few years that tell you If you will read this, you will have this feeling. You have these wonderful feelings. Your life will turn out. Everything will be fine. You know. And Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, is the only place where they offer you something, in our case called the 12 promises, and they actually come true. And the reason I know they come true, because they came true in my life again and again. They don't stay true because I screw them up. But the irony of it is, the guy that wrote them, they haven't even come true to him yet. He wrote them on Speca. Yes, I don't know what the hell he wrote them on. I think I'd like to have fear of financial insecurity. Which leads many people to feel this book is divinely inspired, because everything in it comes true. If you stay here long enough and keep doing the things, it really is amazing. And it comes true to cynics and disillusioned people. And I would say for most people like me, if you're like me, you get here, you really are not caught up much in what they're promising you it's going to be all right, because you've heard it again and again and again. And you go to these therapies, and you go to AA and get arrested maybe again. I remember once upon a time thinking to myself in a moment of cynicism, you know, traffic cop pulls you over and gives you tests for drunkenness. It's too bad there isn't somebody out there, for God's sakes, that can test you for what's really wrong, you know. Okay, have me blow up a balloon to measure the amount of alcohol in my body. Why don't you have a balloon to have me blow up to measure the amount of loneliness in me? Then maybe you'll understand it a little bit better. Or take a drop of blood in my ear to see how much alcohol in my blood. Why don't you take a drop of blood in my ear and measure how much I've been hurt in the last week and rejected and feel bad? You want me to walk a white line to see if I'm sober? Why don't you have me walk a white line to see if anybody really likes me? And on and on. But they don't. All I've discovered, I discovered as a boy 15 years old in a ship in the Pacific Ocean, and thereafter. A few drinks of alcohol makes me feel significantly better, faster than anything else I ever found. And I know I'm not an alcoholic, because when I don't drink alcohol, the only thing that happens is the things that make me crazy come back. I joke about being in that insane asylum in Texas, but that was not a joke at all, because I was in there because I was trying to not drink. And one day it got so bad I committed suicide and literally died and had to be brought back to life to be measured in a hospital, to be put in a psychiatric ward, to be committed to the state insane asylum as a relatively hopeless case of schizophrenia, of dual personality. That's the best they came up with the diagnosis. Some trace of paranoia, I suppose, and extreme depression. And I was there for about 2 weeks and suddenly realized, I thought, I got to get out of here. You know, this, I don't mind dying, but I hate to be confined. And I escaped, and most of you know that story, that they told me it's an escape-proof hospital. And I thought, ha. It took me about 2 weeks to find a way to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over a short fence. And I was loose. But it is an escape-proof hospital, it turns out. You don't know till you get out, because you suddenly discover they can see you running for 3 days out there. And you feel like such a fool in your white bathrobe just out there. And it's just a matter of time till somebody's field glasses pick you up and go, well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me a whole autumn of electric shock treatments, I believe 40, as I heard later. And the thing about shock treatments, when you get a lot of them, you don't ever remember taking any of them. I don't remember ever taking a shock treatment. I don't remember going to that hospital. I don't remember directing the opera before I went to the hospital. I know I did, because I got a program home. Remember a few years ago, around somewhere 5 years, I went to the library and got a record of that opera and played it. And it's just like hearing a band concert across the lake. Occasionally you'd hear a strain you could recognize, but the rest was just all gone with the wind, boy. Out in Terra somewhere. And that's what a lot of shock treatments does. And what the only thing I remember about shock treatments is a horrible memory, is that when you're coming off shock treatments in the 1950s in these southern hospitals, terrible places, old red brick buildings with grimy bars and screens, and I was called on the violent ward and the violent porch of the violent ward. I don't know how to get off on this subject, but anyway, I go down to that hospital. I have been going down to that hospital for 25 years, about once a year, to go in and give talks to the patients there, to give them some kind of hope. Not to the patients that on Ward 5, though. I mean, I tell you how you look at Ward 5, and you look through there, and it's heavily screened and heavily barred, and all you can see is you can see shadows. What you see is just shadows going by like this. Because all they do in that ward, mostly when they're moving, they walk till they get to a wall, then they turn around and walk back. They do that till they get tired, and they sit down for a while. And you got a thing on so you don't drool on your robe. And I remember coming out of shock treatments little by little in that condition, and wondering, where am I? Because I had no memory of ever going to Texas. Last I remember, I was living in San Francisco. And here I was, what the hell am I doing here? Completely, almost 2 years of Texas, completely gone. And I had been working in a big advertising agency, and I'd been on the faculty of the university, and all these things, and my family's here. I had no idea, for a long time, I didn't even know my name was. Somebody told me. But little by little, it gets better. You get some memory back, and pretty soon you get your instincts to, I want to survive. And what they do then, when you're able to function pretty well, they take you off the porch and give you a bed inside, and then, if you're young and strong as I was, you get a little job. And the little job is, you go in and hold a leg or an arm of someone getting shock treatments. Because they didn't have enough attendants for the attendants to do it. So my memory of shock treatments is watching, holding the guy's leg, and I don't know if you've ever seen a shock treatment, but it's like being electrocuted. The body goes, and they have a thing in his lips so he won't bite off his tongue. It's just, and that's all. The memory of that was that I was holding that leg, and somehow they were doing it to me somehow. And I know that every time I went in there, I sweat terrible. And they used to play organ music that indicated they were going. I guess so the ward wouldn't hear that when it went off. And to give you something about brainwashing, 2-3 years later, I could be walking down the street, and if I heard organ music coming out of a storefront, I would break into a sweat. I would break into, well, that is, it's funny, but it is not funny. I mean, it's just a terrible primeval terror. But anyway, that's how, and I finally got it, when I directed that stupid little thing, and I started a hospital newspaper. And how I got out of the hospital was pretending. They started an alcoholic ward while I was there. And that, by that time, enough sense had come back to remind me I'd been in and out of AA for 7 years, so I know all the fool alcoholics. And I pretended to be an alcoholic. And that's how I got out. And I knew I wasn't an alcoholic, but I didn't care. I wanted to get away from those shock treatments. Because if you act badly, some $60 a month attendant to mark you down as restless, moving back to Ward 5. And you're gone. I'll tell you, that's the scariest goddamn thing in the world. And there's no appeal to anybody. And so that's how I get when I stay sober too long, when I'm trying to stay sober. I got to find a way out. There's been a lot of literature written about alcoholism over the years. I read a lot of it. I used to, as a hobby, read a lot of it. Some of my friends in Washington would send me the new things on alcoholism. And I'd get all kinds of wisdom and insights and understanding. But I've come to the gradual conclusion, as I always do again and again, that there is no better description of alcoholism ever written anywhere than the first 2 pages or 3 pages of chapter 3 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. that really describes alcoholics of our type and what we have in common. This inability to admit we are real alcoholics, our efforts to survive. It talks about brief recoveries, which we've all had, followed by still worse relapse, which we've all had. That's why we're here, because we continue to relapse. Of fighting against it until what comes, what happens is this. What happens? You lose your family? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Lose your job, lose your money. I sponsor a guy who still was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. The last day he took a drop. It's a big manufacturer. I've sponsored a lot of people who never were within miles of Skid Row, or even miles of financial discomfort. What is it you reach? You reach what this book talks about. You reach a feeling of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I used to think when I was younger that that's how you get when you're drunk. You get so drunk, you're pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. But that isn't it. As you get older and wiser, you realize and see enough alcoholics. That's the feeling that comes when you're sober again. When you're freshly sober, and it's just, you can't, people want explanations from you for your behavior, and you can't even find one that satisfies you, for Christ's sake, and you got to give them one or else you're in deep trouble. So sometimes the best answer I can find is just defiance. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. I don't want your damn job anyway. Leave me alone. Take the damn kids and get out of here. Leave me alone. I don't care. Because there's nothing else you can do. Sometimes. And so they always talk about alcoholics, drunks committing suicide. Most drunks try to commit suicide. A few years ago, I was about 5 years sober, I was asked to come on one of the radio stations in Hollywood as Alcoholic Al to discuss my story and what AA did. And the guy's leading me through my story, and he suddenly stopped. He said, "You mean to say, Al?" And he had tears in his eyes. That you felt so bad at this time in Texas that you actually committed suicide, and they had to bring you back to life to put you in the insane asylum. You know, I've said that 1,000 times. It didn't startle me. I said, "Yeah, that." I just said it. You know, Al. I've never actually met anyone who tried to commit suicide before. And I've been in AA too long. I said, "My God, I've never met anybody who didn't." Drunks always have committed suicide. Very rarely, you notice, it's always not quite successful. Sometimes they just accidentally kick open a window. Sometimes they do this then. There's the old classic example from years ago in my life. This guy calling me, must be 25 years ago. "Hello, Clancy. I know you've tried to help me, and I appreciate it, but it's been too much for me. I'm going out tonight, Clancy. I'm taking a big overdose of pills, and I don't want anybody to bother me. 1426 3rd Street. Drunks commit suicide as a "come help me, love me, do something," you know. One of the guys used to be a secretary of our group years and years ago, named Chick Parnell. Had a very funny story. One part of his story was funny. He was funny, but he talked about being drunk and holding a knife and saying, "God, if you're there, give me the strength of..." And we all understand that. I'll tell you, when successful alcoholic suicides mostly take place shortly after becoming sober again, in a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. No phone calls, no long notes, no long farewell No long anything, just, I can't stand it. And sometimes they do things like put a pistol in their mouth, or they stab themselves, or do any such ghastly thing. Not, some of them, when they're really goofy, but aren't quite goofy enough, will stand on the edge of buildings. I want to jump. There's one, you have such a member in this group. And he came to me shortly after doing that, and he said, what am I going to do? And I said, well, get in the middle of the building and make a run, for Christ's sake. Well, he didn't want to do that. So I guess we'll have to celebrate his 35th birthday next month, but it won't be happy. I'll tell you, that's when successful suicides take place, shortly after becoming sober. But the nice and sad thing about nature is this. No matter how sad your wound, psychologically or emotionally, if you survive and you be halfway normal, Mother Nature will put a little scab over it. And it isn't quite so intense. If it weren't for that, people could not stand deaths we go through. We have sometimes, all of us have deaths of everything. I can't get through a week like this. But Mother Nature puts a scab on. It's the same concept in the sense that, you know, Mother Nature gives to women who have children. And there's terrible trauma of giving birth. But after a while, it doesn't seem so bad. You know, that's why we have second children and third children. Because this is a natural thing. Nothing seems so bad when it's got a little bit of space in between. And then if you can survive long enough, Mother Nature will put a little scab on pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and pretty soon you can function again, and pretty soon your feelings are going to be bad, you can have a few drinks, and try it again. And it happens again and again. It seems to me pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is another word for bottoms. That's why they say there's an endless series of bottoms. You think you can't stand this one? Next time it's down here. Maybe you can't stand that either. You get again and again. A funny little paragraph in our book that they read sometimes when they're reading chapter 3, and people think it's so funny because it just seems out of nowhere. People like me, and I presume like you, change from scotch to brandy. Or some other thing. We'll drink beer only. We'll only drink at home. We'll never drink at home. We'll try to take more physical exercise. We'll read spiritual literature. We'll try taking trips. We'll try not taking trips. We'll try swearing off with and without a solemn oath. Try a lot of things. And you think, well, what a silly bunch of things that is. Why would people do such damn things? Because of one simple reason. Because they are trapped in something else that chapter 3 mentions. And I believe every alcoholic of my type, and I presume it must be your type if you're like me, has been trapped in this same obsession. Maybe never even knew it. But I think one of the few things that alcoholics of our type have absolutely in common is that sooner or later, willingly or unwillingly, knowingly or unknowingly, I must accept and put on and clutch the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates. Not up to the gates, but into the gates of insanity and death. In fact, if the American figures are correct, something over 95% of people like us will do that. That's the current figures of recovery in America. With all the help available, over 95% of alcoholics still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking and brain damage. Why would they do that? Why would anybody do that? How would you go to explain to a Rotary Club or to a church group, these are people who are having terrible times, and yet they insist they can control and enjoy their drinking? It's not like that funny little thing we read in here that we laugh at and smirk at, but it really is kind of sad thing about it. The guy who is the jaywalker, who gets hit by a car and gets better, and goes out and gets hit by a bus and gets better, and gets, you think, ha 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 ha, dummy. But that is me and that is you, put in a different context. Why do I think, why must I maintain this obsession? Because of one simple reason. I've gotten to the point where I now realize I can't bear to stay sober indefinitely, and drinking is getting me into trouble that I can't handle. So I try to stay sober, and it's impossible. You get to a point, again to quote this book, where there is no adequate defense against the first drink for bedeviled, frightened, lonely, crazed people. And yet if I drink, they say, if you drink, if you wind up in this condition again, you're out of your job, I'm taking the children and leaving, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, threats. And yet you're going to drink sooner or later, because if you don't, you go crazy. In fact, it's almost impossible to explain this to anybody. You know, you can see it in retrospect. I don't know very many things about, except alcoholism. For in a sense, you must drink, eventually drink, to forget what drinking is doing to you. Isn't that ironic? But you don't see it that way. All I know is I had some bad breaks and I drank a lot and I got these kind of jams that make you feel so bad I'm going to have a few drinks to get through it. But really, you're drinking to forget you're drinking. And we've all done it. It has nothing to do with being a skid row. It has something to do with pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that's why people like me can't really come to believe very well that these phrases and these rather simple steps and these things they have on the wall, well-meaning people, but damn it, my case is different. Well, you don't say it, because you discover if you say it, they laugh at you. Try that, newcomer. Go and say, my case is different. Ha 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 ha, isn't our things your case is different. At my first meeting, I said that. I think, as I recall, 40 years ago, 43 years ago, my first meeting, and I told my kids, I recall they laughed at me, and I never said it again. I always knew it, but I never said it, because I cannot bear to be publicly laughed at. And very few people like me, or you, can, in my opinion. Public humiliation is probably ranks right up in there as bad an emotion as I'm familiar with. Which is, again, I say this again and again, sounds funny, but today, why still, if I have any say about it, if I have any knowledge of it, I do not permit people I sponsor to own handguns in their homes. Because I watched a couple times years ago, guys in moments of extreme rage take a gun and do something they wouldn't have done if they had to walk across the street to get it. I'll tell you what changed their lives. There's another reason that I, in my opinion, alcoholics of my type, I would not think should have alcohol in their home on a continuing basis. I've had alcohol in my home a lot of times for particular things, my daughter's reception, my daughter's wedding, another daughter's wedding, had the house. But I wouldn't have it in the house. Now you say, well, if you're going to drink anyway, for Christ's sake, what difference if it's in the house or in a bar? The difference is I want air to hit my face before I drink it. Most of us know our old friend Eddie Regan, the old timer, who was a really great AA. And just one night, his wife was grinding him one too many times. And he went in the kitchen, and she said something about, and he was 10 years sober. And speaker and sponsor and wonderful man. But he was just hungry and tired and cross. And she ground him one more time. And he, boom. And away he went drunk. And he laboriously got back, almost didn't. I'll tell you, he never had any alcohol in his home again. Now you say, as I say, I know you can drink if you want to drink. I can drink if I want to drink. But I don't want to do it on that momentary flash in which you're momentarily crazy. And if you're like me, as intense as I am, the time may come when enough combinations happen so you're momentarily crazy. to do things you'd never do 5 minutes later. But public humiliation kept me from saying how his case was different, and it will almost any new person who's been laughed at, but you know it deep in your gut, which is why it's really unusual. As Jim said tonight, and it's been said so many times, it's almost a trite thing, but to the new guy, maybe you never heard it before. And we've heard it so many times, we're blasé about it, but we shouldn't be. This room is full of miracles. This is a room full of miracles, because in some strange way that no one can really exactly define, people like you and me who cannot be helped are sitting sober with some degree of dignity, with some degree of hope that things will get better, together in a room. Some of us have been here for years and years and years. There's more sobriety sitting behind me on the stage than was present in the world in 1938. And here we are, and the biggest enemy we have to take it for granted. This miracle we take for granted. The very thing that if I could go to that cancer patient and say, would you do this? After I'm feeling comfortable, I don't want to do it. I go to that AIDS patient and say, would you do this? He'd say, yes. But after all, I don't want to do it. Because that comes, there's one other terminal condition I suffer from, and that's called being a human being. And human beings have a tendency to become intellectually slothful and lazy and ungrateful and take things for granted. And that's just a nature of things. That's why all churches preach days of thanksgiving and gratitude, trying to jumpstart a little feeling in there. That's why all Elia Mosner charitable organizations do that. And we do it a lot, and we hear it so much, it just doesn't seem like that much. And so therefore, people like you, or at least like me, have three great roles to play. One, we must become desperate and pained enough to get here. We must become hopeless enough to surrender our intellect to take actions that ordinarily I would not take if I were not so desperate. And the third role of all things is to, once this gets better, not to take it for granted. Isn't that strange? You can't think of anything in the world where more people should be grateful than here. But if you are like me, gratitude is something that comes once in a while. If you want gratitude, you got to think about it. You got to find something to be grateful about. It's no mistake that generations of sponsors in every 12-step program have told generations of babies, have you made your gratitude list? Have you done the things to be grateful for? Have you surrendered? People like me who come here cynical about God, because God, if he exists, is a cruel, vicious, punishing, vengeful God. And I feel I dislike him mainly because I know I am evil. That's why. I don't see it that way at the time, but looking back I can see it. People who are evil are not liable to look at God with love or affection. I want to prefer to believe there's no God, because if God exists, I am damned. To hell with God. And to come here and accept the concept that there may be a power greater than yourself. You say, but I can't accept God. Okay? Can you accept AA? Some people can't. Can you accept a sponsor? Maybe. Try that. As my sponsor told me, he said, can't you believe in AA? Can't you believe in God? And I said, no. And he said, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, yes, you are. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And that was all right with me, because he couldn't send me to hell. I couldn't play a sick little game with him. And if you're new or not familiar with what we're doing here, it's a strange place. because it goes against the grain of any type of treatment you ever had before. Treatments are always the same. We're going to help you. We're going to straighten out your thinking. And your life is going to get better. But we're going to get to the root of your thinking, and we're going to straighten it out. Then your actions will get better. And AA says, we don't want to hear about it. We don't even think about it. I'm not going to think about it. I think I'm going crazy. Never mind. People are looking at me funny and passing buses. Yeah, who cares? Yeah. What shall I do? Oh, work accept. There's nothing wrong with it. Me. It's these, they're doing it to me. AA has a strange recovery procedure. And put it in its simplest form, it's this. You take actions, and eventually your thinking will change. You have no way in God's world to wait for your thinking to change before you get better. You've got to have something going for a long time before that. And that's what makes AA work. Later on, years later, medicine described this as behavioral modification and made stunning breakthroughs. But they can't really do it very well because they can't enforce the behavioral modification. We can hear, because that's what it's about. We can tell people, you know, if you don't want to do it this way, maybe the next time you get sober, you can do it this way. We have the greatest 12-stepper in AA is a man named John Barleycorn. And every so often he comes to you and gathers up the fools and just away he goes. You don't see him for a while. And I was one of those he's gathered up year after year. But you wind up desperate, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization one more time, with or without material things, that's extraneous. And then you must come here and you must do something that you almost have to be totally desperate to do. Surrender your judgment as to what is appropriate for you to do. What will help you? There isn't any group in the world, I don't suppose, that asks you to do that, to give up. You just know that this guy is trying to help me. I know he means well. I know he wants to help me, but he can't possibly know as much about me as I do. How could he make judgments about what I need? And I must act as though he knows it, even though I know he doesn't. And I must take actions and sit in meetings and take dumb things and shake hands and try to be honest when nobody's looking and do all sorts of things that just seem to be have no application to anything. And these things can work. Eventually take an inventory. Tell things I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist to some boob who I'm not sure I trust. You know. People said, why wouldn't you tell everything to your psychiatrist? Very simple. When you're paying that kind of dough, you can't risk rejection. No one wants to sit there and think, oh, here it comes. Get out of my office, you sick bastard. And you read it to someone. And you surrender to God and ask Him to help you get rid of these defects of character. Become willing to. And somehow ask Him to get rid of them. That doesn't mean God's going to come through a window and get rid of them. That just means you are in effect saying, I am now willing to do what is necessary to change these things. Like, I'm trying to get better and I want to get better. And you wind up making amends to people you'd have sworn owed you amends. And maybe they do, but it doesn't make a difference what they do. I make amends to get rid of my hatred of them. I have never really hated anyone after I made an amend to them. And I hated a number of people that I made amends to. And I debated my sponsor with it at length about, he owes me an amend much more than I do. Talk about my own father. I didn't talk to him for years. That son of a bitch ruined my life with his demands on me. My sponsor, I say, well, it may be, kid, but you were a bad son too. So we're not concerned what he did. We're trying to get you better. He may have to die a sad old man, but you're going to die straightened out. And I made amends, and as I made amends, my perception of my father changed, and he made some amends, and his perception of me changed, and we wound up probably one of the closer fathers and sons you ever saw for 20 years. He lived with us in his old age. When he got sick and went going to die, he went back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with all the Norwegians and died. And so I remember sitting at his funeral thinking, in a church about this size, the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, sitting there thinking, isn't that amazing? If I hadn't been so desperate, if my sponsor hadn't been able to take advantage of my sickness and make me take actions that I didn't want to take, to this day, I would be hating that old man. And I'd think, that dirty old filthy son of a bitch. And instead, I'm just glad I had 20 years with my father. And we had good friends. And I hope that someday my children will feel as warm toward me as my father did. I did toward my father. I don't know. I mean, you know, when I'm older, they don't need dough anymore. They all love me now. Hi, Dad. No, they don't do that. I'm just kidding. They've grown up. They don't do it anymore. It's hard to hold them. The actions of AA are strange. And men sometimes are not what you want them to be. I went all the way back to Dallas one time to make an amend to a guy who I'd burned badly when I worked for him. They repossessed my car while I was working there. So I stole the company truck and got drunk and I lost the truck. And they're just idiots. And I went back to the guy, saw him. I said, Doug, I came back to make amends to you. He said, what, make amends? You mean for stealing our truck that time? I said, yeah, I'm an alcoholic now, and I'm an AA. He says, you're not an alcoholic. What are you in an AA for? I said, well, why do you think I did these things? Because I thought you were a phony son of a bitch. And I almost went over the desk and had a new amend to make. Is that what you think? I'll teach you about God and love, you're crippled. But I choked it back, and when I left my office, I never hated that man again. I have never hated anyone I made an amend to. It's hard to think that all of the steps you do here are designed to make you feel better, not the person you're doing them to. And yet people like me, if you're like me, keep from doing it because I don't want to give them the satisfaction. It's such a dumb, it's like a fourth step, holding back certain things. It's like saying you, some divine person saying, we're going to give you complete freedom if you'll turn state's evidence. And you say, I'll just turn part of it. I want to keep some of the jail time to myself, you know. And then the last three steps are continuing to do these things. And that's where we kind of fall down sometimes, I guess. Because when things are good, the heat's off. And I am motivated by heat. I am not motivated by comfort. I'm not motivated by ease. I'm not motivated by convenience. And so every so often I have to remind myself that I got to sit in the AA meetings. Sit in the AA meetings 3-4 nights a week now, after all 34 years of sobriety. My phone is still listed in the LA County, all the city phone directories in the city of Los Angeles, so that some boob can call me up if he wants to commit suicide and I can tell him how to do it. That's why I have tried not to say no to AA requests. A lot of people, sometimes I get very tired of that. But when my first sponsor died, I got a second sponsor who was the most active man I ever knew in AA, and he always said yes to everything. And he always felt better than the people who said he was doing too much. So I keep doing it. And I don't know that it's working for me like it worked for him, but I know this, that today I had a good day. I got up this morning and I played softball, 2 games of softball, and served lunch and played volleyball and then put on the house lights with very little help. Watched newcomers tumble into the shrubbery. A couple of them are still there. We can't get to them. We've thrown them a 12 and 12 and came out here at night. And I feel younger than I felt the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1958. Now, there's something to be said for that. Now, wouldn't you think that I would be grateful every fiber of my being? I'm not. I'm not ungrateful. But sometimes more important things transcend it. Like, Like my bookkeeper didn't get the monthly report done on time. That's more important than my life, isn't it? Someone had a bad attitude that my family did not have things ready on time. On and on and on, just petty crap. But I'm a human being, so I have to overcome that. And one of the great things I have to overcome, and you have to overcome too if you're like me, is emotional binges. Because emotional binges are always, you know, even highs. You think, but this is a high, there's nothing wrong with this. Emotional highs are always followed by emotional lows. If you want to beat lows, you beat it on the way up, not on the way down. Because once you have the dance, the band is waiting down here. To say it, no, to stay this way, but to stay at least in the ball game. Which is why people like me, even today, although it really isn't terribly necessary, but I can find it, I have to a little bit fight the binge of Christmas. Christmas is such a wonderful thing. It's just everybody's in Christmas. It's socially acceptable to be crazed at this time of year. We're in the middle of a bunch of the Skid Row's full of little tiny Oriental shops now. I don't know where to get the stuff. Hijack it off American ships, I guess, but nobody can speak English, but they got thousands of things. And the people just hoard in down there. They push poor Skid Row's guys out of the way. Get out of the way! And it's just crazy. I look out my window and I think, God, that's what I call living. You know, that's Christmas. And that's why for 34 Christmases, this is my 35th sober Christmas, I've had to remember to keep things in perspective. I still enjoy Christmas, but I find myself moving over every so often. I find myself moving into that emotional binge state, whether it's cards out in time or whether it's presents or who did what for me. And I got it as much as I can. Stay, move back. And that's why this is always known as an anti-Christmas talk. Because it really isn't an anti-Christmas talk. It's an anti-emotional binge talk is what it is. And that's why sometimes we got to remember that they have Christmas so they can binge, but we have 364 other days that we have to live in and survive in. And we have to live with some degree of dignity through a period. And we have to give them their Christmas. And I want my grandkids to be just as excited as they can be on Christmas morning. And I want my children to be happy on Christmas morning. I want my wife to be happy. I want my friends to be happy. I want them all to have a wonderful Christmas. But I long ago gave up putting my happiness based on whether I got something, not even knowing what it was that I wanted. You know, have you ever noticed that? All I know is that I didn't get what I wanted. I don't know what I wanted, but I didn't get it. And you'll find that twinge every Christmas. So I got to just accept the fact, well, got the same old wonderful things. Same old socks and books that I don't like and candy I can't eat and inspirational prayers that I'm going to bury in the bottom of my drawer as soon as I get out of here. But I want them to have fun. And I'm in luck because as soon as they open their presents, I open my presents, I jump in my car and go down to the Midnight Mission where we serve 3,500 meals and spend all day on that. And I'm out of it because I'm into somebody else. But most people don't have that privilege. So you got to kind of remember that Christmas is a wonderful thing, noble thing, happy thing. But it is not a day that you can allow yourself the luxury of an emotional drink. The price is too big. So, at this meeting every year, I always wind up, as I'm going to wind up now, by not wishing you a Merry Christmas, not wishing you a Happy New Year, not wishing you a prosperous 1993, but to do it much more realistic. I'd rather wish you a merry February 8th, because that's as important as December 25th in your life and mine, and a very happy June 22nd, and a prosperous August, and a sober and fruitful October, perhaps with some tinges of things that will help us remember to be grateful that we are living in a world that you and I cannot live in, that we are carrying ourselves with some degree of dignity, and yet our biggest enemy is our own head saying, but it's not enough. It is more than enough. It is something people for 4,000 years have been searching for, and you and I have found it, and for God's sakes, we've got to hang on to it. We've got to transmit it to those behind us. And we have to keep AA in its present form so that my grandchildren and yours will come here and get the same answers and not get some adjustments made by a counselor in a failing recovery home that he thinks will sound better. AA is a very simple thing, as it always is. I say it again and again because I want to hear myself remember it. It is not the book, the meetings, the people. All these things are important secondary aids to Alcoholics Anonymous. What Alcoholics Anonymous is as it is tonight, December 19th, 1992, as it was June 10th, 1935. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he can begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. That is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what you and I have. Let us cherish it. Thank you.